Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight, as part of the university's Institute for Philosophy and Religion annual lecture series, we'll hear from Tufts University Visiting Professor of International Diplomacy, Mark Gopin. Professor Gopin's most recent work includes the book Between Eden and Armageddon, a study of myth, symbol, and primal feelings as they relate to conflict resolution. Professor Gopin will elaborate on those themes and discuss their impact on face-to-face conversations he had with Yasser Arafat and other Palestinians as part of a group seeking to find a peaceful solution to the Middle East conflict. Here now with a participant observer's critical analysis of Jewish-Islamic negotiations in Israel and Palestine is Professor Mark Gopin.
I want to share with you tonight a journey into a very unusual universe. And I always pinch myself about how I got into this universe. I mean, it's quite comforting to be in an Institute of Philosophy and Religion because this is where I began. I began this journey in studying religious ethics, and for a variety of reasons found that the abstract study of the subject that couldn't translate into the hardest details of the world became frustrating to me, and a simple fascination with the question of a moral dilemma and what one does about moral dilemmas. And if you ask that question too hard, you're going to get in a lot of trouble in terms of your personal destiny, because there's no place as real in terms of moral dilemmas as the place of violence and war. So I want to put a frame on a story that I'll tell you about the odd place of being a participant observer, or a scholar practitioner more precisely than when I first wrote this title. The field that some of us have created is basically a composite of a series of challenges to social science of understanding the nature of human behavior in terms of peace and violence, pro-social values and anti-social values, compassion and empathy on one side, and a kind of almost demonic barbarism on the other, and how we have all these capacities at the same time. This is a question that is basic to many, many different branches, competing branches of psychology, but it is also a fundamental crux in anthropological study of multiple societies around the world. I became fascinated by a field that I discovered almost by accident years ago at George Mason University, and that field that has burgeoned since then is conflict analysis and conflict resolution. And it turns out the conflict analysis and resolution is a composite itself of basically almost nobody got PhDs and still doesn't in conflict analysis and resolution. So people develop the field coming from different fields. There are people from anthropology, from social psychology, from sociology, for the most part. And then there were anthropologists who were the troublemakers. And then I came in from religion, and I was really a troublemaker. Because basically that as this field invented its constructs and tried to invent these constructs, more and more those of us who are anthropologists and even political scientists who studied comparative societies, my colleague Mark Ross, who's a brilliant man in this field, and Kevin Averick, who's a brilliant anthropologist, and we all started having some issues with the fact that conflict analysis and resolution and its effect on diplomacy and negotiation was woefully inadequate to facing, for lack of a better word, the non-rational side of human experience, and that the non-rational side of human experience was only perceived as a problem to be solved. In other words, something to be removed as an issue, something to be suppressed, or something to be taken away from the formula so that we can get on with the real business of negotiation. And to this day, social science of diplomacy and negotiation and conflict resolution is what dominates the style and the character and the substance of thousands of negotiations around the world for treaties and for the basic state-to-state relations. but also the attempted negotiations to solve intractable conflicts, conflicts that go on for years and years, sometimes for generations. And it became obvious to us that when it comes to intractable conflict, these methods helped somewhat, and then at other times they failed miserably. And as I got into the research more and more, I realized that not only were they failing, they actually were causing a lot of the problems. So that as time has gone on, I've become fascinated by, and so others in the field, like Bill Urey, who wrote originally with Roger Fisher, started to realize that the third party and every construct of conflict is first party, second party, and then there are those who attempt to be in the in-between space, that the third party was the problem. Because in many ways, first and second parties, from a non-rational perspective, are supposed to be doing what they do. In other words, the psychodynamic and psychological patterns of cycles of violence are such that people almost engage, especially collective groups, engage in a predictable pattern of escalation, of demonization, of slow and steady mimesis, where both parties end up resembling each other in odd and strange ways, where their propaganda resembles the propaganda of both groups resemble themselves. And only in studying the deeper aspects of psychology that Van McVolkin has pioneered, V-O-L-K-N, the need to have enemies and allies, do we start to see that there were deeper dynamic processes going on. And that if you are to break the cycle of that, then a third party has to be very self-aware, very keenly tuned in to the non-rational aspects of the dynamic, and then very tuned in to how one works with the emotional primal side of the human experience in a way that allows people to wake up from that unconscious primal process so that they can get to more rational negotiations, interest-based negotiations, rational compromise, and so on. In other words, the fundamental argument of the various schools of psychological thought for a long time has been that there is such a thing as more reasonable human behavior. We know that there is a degree of normality to some people more than others, and that is the stuff and substance of civility and covenants and social contracts. And that there is no reason for, in the negotiation of a treaty over rights to various fisheries, that people go into their life histories and what their fathers did to them, and that it would be a waste of time. But in point of fact, when human relations break down to such a severe degree that no rational negotiations are working, that deeper things need to be studied in order to help people to a new space. In the context of that, I started to realize that religion was this dark abyss in the academy. And the academy is the handmaiden of state-to-state diplomacy. Religion is a dark abyss. It has been compartmentalized within the study of human phenomena within the university, but it's hardly something that is easily subject to cross-disciplinary investigations. For a variety of reasons, and many of them subject to the just very understandable human biases of social science and social scientists. The realm of religion is a realm of trouble for many people who have escaped from repressive religious structures, and there are innumerable religious structures that are repressive around the world in all the major organized religions. And so that it got to the absurd degree that whenever I would be allowed to speak, this was years ago, before it became obvious that religion was such a key to the suicide bombings in Israel and the Middle East. If I spoke about religion as a pathology and a problem, then I got a full audience. The moment I spoke about it as a solution, it was dangerous because it was threatening the public order. And basically it involves the global struggle today for the public space between the realms of organized religion and the realms of secular culture, where there are millions and millions of human beings who are religious who are perfectly comfortable with the public space either being shared or being exclusively secular, but where we see en masse tens of millions of people around the world who are determined to take back that space in the name of religion and religious extremism. So in the midst of that, to try and come up with a constructive relationship with diplomacy and third-party intervention has not been easy. In fact, it's been inherently flawed on a constant basis. So I'd like to explore some of that, explore what we've accomplished so far on a theoretical level. What we've accomplished so far, my own work and Scott Appleby, Ambivalence of the Sacred and others, is that we've established what Scott refers to as the ambivalence of the sacred, of the hermeneutical and behavioral possibility of religion to be at the forefront of the most aggressive forms of peacemaking and successful forms of peacemaking that the world has seen in the hands of people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King and the Dalai Lama, who single-handedly really prevented millions of people who could have been afflicted or died if it had not been for their vision. And then on the other hand, we know, and it goes without saying, how many millions of people have died in history because of religiously inspired violence. Now, the political usages of this are such that there's a strong tendency, especially since September 11th, to deny that authentic religion causes violence. It's religion hijacked. It's religion at the hands of people who are pathological, and so on and so forth. And for political and diplomatic reasons, it's probably a good idea to not delve too deeply into the extremely religious, extremely violent texts within the world's religious traditions at the present time, or to dwell on them, especially if one does it in an uneven-handed way. And it's very hard for people not to do that. But for those of us who are scholars of this and those of us who really want to help at a deep level, no one helps a cancerous agent. Nobody helps something that's really destructive in this world without understanding it in its depths. And there's a whole lot of blindness going on to the depths of the religious experience of violence. The truth is that with all of the pacifist visions in human history in the name of religion, there's also been the most passionate embrace of violence as a religious experience, not just a necessity, not just a legal necessity, but an experience. And to know that and to know the texts, to see that the same Bible that commands people to love your neighbor as yourself, to help your enemy in Exodus 23, to help your enemy. The same texts that say that killing is a sin, do not murder, also says that you must kill every man, woman, and child of the Amalekite nation or of the seven nations of Canaan. That the saints that one will see saying the most beautiful poetic texts in the Middle Ages will also report from time to time, like Bernard of Clairvaux, on the glorious vision of the streets filled with blood in Jerusalem in the Crusades. What a glorious sacrifice. And now we see this letter from Muhammad Atta, which very painful to see, but very important to look at that last will and testament and that last set of instructions, where the word revenge doesn't even exist. It's not an angry document. It's about going to meet God and being pure before you do, and about to be on paradise, and how you prepare yourself to meet God in that last moment. And of course, he's talking about people who will kill 3,000 people in an instant. So this has many expressions around the world and throughout history. And that, too, is part of the use of the sacred and of power in the religious imagination. It is clearly an engagement with the primal forces of the human being. And the primal forces of the human being have both an incredible capacity, a passionate capacity for barbarity, and a passionate capacity for altruism, for surrender, for care, for empathy, for self-sacrifice. And all of these things flow within religious experience. What we've done is try to figure out and try to experiment and examine history as to how one takes this ambivalence and these multiple capacities of religious experience and religious texts and interpretation of texts and move them in the direction that they can coexist with what, for the most part, the global community has come to, in some ways, a new quasi-religion, believe is the only hope for the future of humanity, which is freedom, democracy, civil rights, universal human rights, etc. It's an evolving secular religion of the human community. It's a religion that many people who are religious embrace from many of the world's religions. I use the word religion rather loosely, in case you haven't noticed. But it is something that is emerging and powerful and global. It's just that at the same time, there are countervailing trends moving in the opposite direction. So what Scott and I and others and the anthropologists among us, the political scientists have tried to theorize, how do we see and when do we see the possibility of moving things in the opposite direction? I'll give you an example of just something that just comes to mind right now. Mark Ross has done some interesting writing and research on Ireland, on Northern Ireland. I was in Belfast and I work with people there, and I'll be there again in June. And he and I are both fascinated by the marches. And one of my students at Fletcher did a brilliant paper. This is frighteningly brilliant. I mean, she's undergraduate. Oh, sorry. I don't know if anybody here is undergraduate, but I mean, it's an undergraduate paper, which is just extraordinary. On the symbolism, the intricate symbolisms, the secret symbolisms of the Protestant marches. And the reason why we have to go such into the depths of these symbols is because if symbols and myths and metaphors and rituals are the way that people get into hell, a hell of their own making, then we argue that they are the way that people can get out of that hell. And that so far, elite rational negotiations in the castle far away or in London or in the United States just simply can't affect those marches one iota. And so we started to think about alternative marches. We started to think about how you can enter into a conversation with people on the ground. And by the way, the Irish peacemakers, of all the peacemakers I've ever met, are the most brilliant, not surprisingly, at symbolic processes of change. Symbolic processes of change. Now, I don't want to get too far afield with the kind of work and thinking that we're doing about Ireland. I want to get into the question of Israel and Palestine. It's important to understand just how much things fell apart at Camp David because of the Temple Mount, and how much the Temple Mount, the Haram al-Sharif, that 1 square kilometer, and Jerusalem itself, the old city of Jerusalem, is at the core of the imaginative conflict, of the symbolic conflict that embraces here not just the Israeli people and the Palestinian people, but literally billions of people around the world. And one of the reasons why this conflict is so intractable is that there are no third parties who are not part of the conflict. There are third parties who think they're part of the conflict. They're not part of the conflict. They think they're not. They're Americans. They're Protestant. They're Catholic. They're secular. But they all come from monotheistic cultures that are deeply related to that ancient spot. And one of the reasons why this isn't working out so far is that so far, very, very few people have demonstrated the capacity to listen to the depths of the story and the mythic significance and the pathology of all sides of this conflict. So that when I got a call from somebody inside the State Department in July, before the Intifada began, and he just said in frustration, with his teeth gritted, can somebody please explain to them that this is also a Jewish spot for 2,000 years? You know, this was somebody who was usually very diplomatic and didn't like to say at all what was going wrong or going right. And so it was very clear, and if that wasn't astonishing to me enough, I sat with a prominent, rather secular Palestinian intellectual in Eastern Jerusalem, very, very smart man, who had been sitting for years with Jews and Muslims on the subject of Jerusalem. And he said to me, until then, we had no idea, nobody ever told us that this was important. And you know, I believed him. Because it turns out that the secular Israelis who were negotiating with them didn't know it was important to them until it came up. That's what's so fascinating about primal symbols. They're not important until they hit you in the face. That's what's so captivating about it. And so that we have this moment of 13 years of Oslo, built on billions of dollars of projects that went down the tubes and corruption and all sorts of problems. And 12 police forces ending up in the West Bank. And not a single conversation on the most primal space of the rage and the longing and the mourning and the aspirations of that 1 square kilometer. And I said to myself that all parties unconsciously, including the Americans and the Europeans, conspired to not do this unconsciously because they didn't have a way to deal with it. My friends, who are totally ignored by all of this, but who at the same time have linkages to the foreign ministry and to Arafat, sit every Friday morning right opposite the Western Wall. Jews, Muslims, and Christians, Sufis. And they sit there and they chant for an hour, Shalom and Salam. And people come and visit them, and they keep chanting. Now, do they have any impact on the leadership? No. On the other hand, you'd be surprised at how much is going on and was going on behind the surface, beneath the surface, between these kind of actors and people at the highest and elite level. And that's exactly what we tried to do. What happened was, is that I went to Israel with an intention to do something that's called active listening, active compassionate listening. And I went with a certain group called Initiatives of Change or Moral Rearmament that has many flaws in its peacemaking methods, but is brilliant at creating relationships. And for a lot of us in conflict resolution theory, particularly coming out of religious modes, conflict transformation, the Mennonite model, John Paul Lederach, relationship building, not dialogue, relationship building involving symbols and gestures and deeds was the key to what they had seen in changed relationships in Latin America and Africa and other places. And so we decided that we were going to try and do this in Israel-Palestine, which, by the way, this group had failed to do until then, because they themselves had had a problem with the capacity for empathy simultaneously with both Arabs and Jews. And they knew it. And that's why I was working with them, because they knew that they were trying to change that incapacity, that need, finally, when you're part of this, to demonize one side and fantasize about the other, or to be in denial about the other. Particularly the Christian world is divided here between those who demonize the Jews and are in denial about the Palestinian Authority and the PLO and Islamic terrorism, etc., and those who need to demonize the Muslims and are in denial of the behavior of the Israel Defense Forces and the things that Israel did to contribute to the misery of the Palestinian people. And so by these two forces supporting both sides, they actually make the conflict worse because they strengthen both sides. That's what's so dangerous about being a so-called peacemaker and a third party, because unless you have that discipline of radical empathy simultaneously with all sides, then you become part of the problem in the long run. And so we went and we decided to speak to everybody across the section, classic second-track diplomacy, all the way from Haredi and Hasidic rebbes, who I had contacts with, to Sephardi cultural leaders, to members of Israeli parliament, to people in the foreign ministry, all the way to Palestinian intellectuals and Palestinian activists and Palestinian professors and so on. Simple Palestinian newlyweds were on the list at that point. But and a West Bank rabbi. But in the process of doing that classic Track 2 work, I became engaged with certain people who were engaged in a process that we now call track one and a half diplomacy, which was that we were moving in between these actors on the ground, mostly of a religious nature, and we were trying to get to the elites here, the prime minister and the chairman, or the president of Palestine and the prime minister of Israel, to behave in certain ways that would forward a religious parallel peace process. Now, that has yielded some results, but the results have been completely overshadowed by the absurd levels of violence and barbarity that have come up. After several years of working on a religious peace treaty, finally, there was a meeting in Alexandria just last week or 2 weeks ago. And the signatories to that included the Sephardic Chief Rabbi of Israel, the Deputy Foreign Minister of the Israeli government, the Minister of the PA, Talal Sidr, the Chief Sheikh of Al-Azhar University, the second in command to the Mufti of Jerusalem, and a number of religious Christian clerics of the heads of the churches in Israel. It was a remarkable accomplishment, truly. It was the flowering of much of what we had done. It fell far short of the kind of symbolic and deed-based gestures that I was calling for. It again focused on a statement. But statements are important, too. It wasn't nearly as much affecting the primal space that I'm talking about. But the fact that all of them could come to the conclusion that the Holy Land is holy to all three faiths, that all must respect the purposes of the Creator, that nobody should shed innocent blood, that they even referred to this as in the name of the God who is almighty, merciful, and compassionate, which for those who know religious texts well know that that's a fusion of a Jewish prolegomena and an Islamic one, because for those of you who know about this. It was a remarkable document. It was far too little, far too late, and it has been skipped over. But never in our work, and in my writings, have we believed that any one moment of this kind of interreligious statement would be enough to stop the violence. What we want is a series of gestures and statements and moments between religious faiths that start to create the cognitive emotional dissonance that breaks the demonized structure of enemy systems. And the evidence is that it takes a long time, but that it eventually causes enough shock to the system by enough people that things start to shift. And once an enemy system shifts, there are enough people in the middle to isolate the radicals on both sides. I had suggestions, and I was on the phone hours at a time just 2 weeks ago, feeding into Alexandria what, you know, they said, if it goes well, what else could we do? And I was focusing on mourning the dead, because the dead infect most conflicts, and the rationalistic methods don't even begin to address the power of the dead to destroy peacemaking. They don't acknowledge that people kill and die for generations because of honoring the dead. So I want the religious leaders and the political leaders to mourn and acknowledge the losses on both sides, both by word and by deed. Various ways of honoring the Torah and the Quran in a very physical way, a very media-based way, that would be a demonstrable evidence of a new era that would drive Hamas crazy. And actually drive a lot of the secularists in Israel crazy as well. But that kind of cognitive dissonance is exactly what we're looking for. In fact, the Jerusalem Post carried a reaction to the Alexandria statement. It was quite wonderful by Herb Kynan, basically tearing it apart as useless, but also interpreting in very interesting ways, but important ways. Said, you see where it says, according to our faith traditions, killing innocents in the name of God is a desecration of the holy name. Desecration of the holy name is a Jewish idea, but killing innocents was in there. He said, you see, it's killing innocents, but the other side doesn't think that we're innocent. Now, this, in fact, has a long history. And in fact, there were a number of statements since September 11th where leading sheikhs said, suicide bombing is evil, except in Israel. Because there it's a legitimate fight. And there's been enormous political struggle going back and forth between these leading sheikhs who are actually controlled heavily by political authorities like Mubarak, but at the same time buffeted and in fear of Hamas, Islamic Brotherhood, etc. And so Kynan only saw the negative. He said, you see, it easily could be interpreted otherwise. And in fact, one of the signatories probably will go back and double speak about it. But there's no doubt about the fact that if this had been a repeated gesture and happened over a period of many months and was followed up with by gestures, and that eventually Sharon and Arafat, who had given permission for this, had they been part of it, it would start to make an impact. This world of entering into a mythic peacemaking, I call it sometimes, is a very strange world indeed. When I eventually came with some of my colleagues and with the West Bank rabbi and the Sufi sheikh, whose life is in constant danger, when we made it into Arafat's office, Arafat sat with us for hours, and we spoke in a mythic universe about a holy land where there were no states. Just simply the Holy Land. And in Arafat's mind, his real vision is Saladin, is to be the liberator of holy spaces in the Holy Land. And he liked the role that we had for him in that protection of holy spaces. He put us on Palestinian television 3 times when I was there. At the same time that this is the man that permits and continues to allow for the continuation of Hamas activity, Tanzim activity, suicide bombing. There's a lot of C4 on the ship that was captured. C4 would be principally used for suicide bombing. He's a man of complete contradiction. And for those of us who tried this, we felt that it wouldn't be the first time in history that you were dealing with relatively unstable leaders who need to be moved and cajoled in one direction. And we felt that the rationalistic methods had failed completely, but that if we could solicit the foreign ministry and rabbis and sheikhs to work together, we could move these leaders, including Sharon, to a different space than they were in before, in terms of their attitude to enemy. I have very good evidence that if we had had a third party that really got this, instead of stonewalling and preventing us repeatedly from doing it. No, I should be fair to the State Department. They never prevented us. They simply ignored us. Said, you have to do this. We can't do it. That was for years before people started dying. But it's very clear that Israelis and Palestinians were both saying, we need somebody to do this for us. Even Arafat was saying that to us. We need the Americans, we need the Americans, we need the Americans. So this is a fascinating moment of the interpenetration of the power of myth and symbol and religious relationships that got right into that strange space of whether major leaders who are killing can stop killing. I want to share with you one more thing, and I should start to close. About the lessons, implications here. At one point in the conversation, this was in the middle of the Intifada, about 6 months into the Intifada, and the meeting was set up because of me. And I know that's strange, but I did various things that were not totally honest in order to have this meeting. I happen to have gotten a letter from President Clinton that supported the work of religion and conflict resolution. And he, the whole effort was not to get the letter, the effort was to get him to be involved in this. He sent me a very nice letter finally, and he said, I'm instructing the National Security Council to take this up. They never called me. That was in 1999. I didn't call them because I thought when somebody says they're going to call, you wait for the call. But apparently you have to call and then beg and then cajole and then get somebody very wealthy to call the National Security Council before this kind of initiative would even be taken remotely seriously. So that never happened. But the letter was all I had. So I faxed the letter to the West Bank. They immediately brought it to Arafat. Arafat was so impressed with the letter that he read it before the Palestinian Assembly and made an announcement that we're going to engage in a religious peace treaty called Hudna in Arabic, in Islam. Hudna means religious ceasefire, and it's one of the things that Muhammad did with enemies that was not quite peace. It was not sulha, it was not reconciliation, but it was a stopping of war. But some sulhas in history, some hudnas in history went on for generations, for many years. And so it's basically a very important legal category with an Islamic approach to law, to war, that leads an opening and a possibility for a change in relationship. And others said Arafat and this sheikh who was part of his government don't have the authority to declare a hudna. Only the people at Al-Azhar in Cairo would be important enough to do this. And of course, I had prominent people in Washington with me on the trip, and we were incensed by the arrogance of that. That once again, we finally have a Palestinian leader and a Palestinian sheikh who are prepared to declare a hudna if the Israelis will do the same. And the statement is that they don't really count. Only leaders in Cairo count. They're the only ones that are going to be taken seriously by Hamas. But they missed the non-rational effort. We were trying to create a bilateral symbol between enemies that was far more important than whether the Sheikh and Al-Azhar said yes or no. We just couldn't convince them of the power of this. So it went on and it went on, and one moment at which I was in the middle of this intifada. And it was after the Hudna failed because of various parties, the Americans, others, didn't want it. I was with Arafat, and he had already been orchestrating this whole intifada, or acquiescing to it, or providing the arms, but whatever you want to call his role, not a very clean role. And I looked into his eyes, and I said to him, you know, I'm a rabbi in my tradition. It's obligatory to comfort people who are mourning. And I want to express my sorrow for the people who have died here. And it stunned them because nobody was talking about the dead. And once they were in that space, the conversation stopped, and I looked at him again and I said, I want to share with you something else from the Talmud. And I looked right into his eyes. And I said, the Talmud says that the world survives only because of three things. Justice, truth, and peace. And then a very wise rabbi said after that, where there is, and I looked, I went right up to his eyeballs and I said, where there is no justice, there will never be peace. But where there is no peace, there can never be justice. And so with the first part of the statement, he knew that I was agreeing with him, that justice was never in the conversations about negotiations. It was always peace, peace, peace. But in the second part, I was saying to him, your methods will never work because they're not based on peace. And he was very astonished by that. And he sat there and he thought about it for a while and he said, this is very important. And it was a very moving or emotional kind of engagement there with rabbis and sheikhs. And the next day, he announced, for the first time in the 6 months of the Intifada, he argued that there should be no killing of civilians. For the first time. It was a blip. It was rolled over. Action, counteraction, revenge, retaliation, punishment. It was finished. The moment was gone. But what we had proved in that moment was the possibility of that moment being multiplied many times in an intercultural process that would slowly, slowly allow for the room for a new vision to take place, particularly if this could happen through mediation between the two leaders behind closed doors. It's a remarkable moment in my life. Very painful, because I was sitting with somebody who had killed many people of my community for a very long time. Okay, so I just want to say to you, I can't go through all of the lessons learned, but in the book, I give a series of very practical cultural de-escalation measures that both sides should be encouraged to take in order for the rational processes of de-escalation and military de-escalation to take place. And I can't go through all of them now. I mentioned mourning. I mentioned the focused on shared study. I mentioned on the symbols of shared mitzvot or deeds that both sides consider to be religious, righteous deeds, like visiting the sick, caring for the land, helping the poor. And for these things to be done in a deeply cultural way and bilateral way as a slow and steady process of any future Oslo process. There never again in history should be an Oslo process that is just about building industrial parks and making sure there are 20 police forces. What a waste of time and human lives. There should be a process that has with it every month a series of cultural processes of change, social change, cultural change, psychological change, by the highest leaders who are willing to be part of this. And only then is there a possibility of uprooting Hamas, of uprooting the most brutal behavior of the IDF, the rejectionists among the settlers, etc. Only with this process can the incredibly powerful forces around the Middle East, funding Hamas, funding rejectionism, only then, if there's a powerful middle from these two peoples, will we be able to withstand the pressures for destruction that are concentrated on this spot, on Jerusalem, on the Temple Mount. So that I believe that we have the answers, but they're going to take a bit of a cultural revolution in those people who see themselves as outside the conflict and how they intervene and what attitudes they now have to the importance and the power of religious symbols, of cultural institutions, of the emotional side of human existence, and of the power of people to change their hearts in a way that yields practical abilities to coexist and to be safe and secure. Thank you very much.
Professor Mark Gopin. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight's lecture is one in a series presented by the university's Institute for Philosophy and Religion. This year, the theme is Promise and Peril, the Paradox of Religion as Resource and Threat. To comment now on Professor Gopin's critical analysis of Jewish-Islamic negotiations is Harvard University Professor of Practice in Religion, Ethnicity, and International Conflict, David Little.
The only point at which I would take a slightly different turn is in regard to something Mark himself mentions in the outline that he passed out but was not able to take up for good reason. I'm not blaming him for that. I'm just calling attention to the fact that he is also attentive to this particular point, and it's one I would like to focus on since I have spent some time worrying about it. It's under the section, as he asks, what remains to be done in the general analysis of religion and peace. And he suggests that we need theoretical work that interrelate human rights research, development studies, religion, and conflict resolution, what some are referring to as human security. And he goes on in another point to emphasize the evolution of a global register of indigenous peace practices critically compared to more universal concerns of conflict resolution and civil society building, such as, for example, human rights, democracy, and pluralism. This begins to lead in the direction that I'm particularly interested in, which is, in a nutshell, the connection between religious conflict resolution and the structural arrangements that are worked out in peace agreements. I mean by structural arrangements the institutional agreements, the territorial agreements, the nuts and bolts questions that finally have to be faced if we are to have some kind of peace arrangement in a place like Israel and Palestine. So that how, I suppose I'm asking, does the work that Mark is doing in creating mythic, symbolic, cultural interconnections between conflicting parties, how does that feed into, contribute to, the actual making of peace, the process according to which peace agreements are hammered out, sometimes under very conflictual circumstances? It's that link between conflict resolution and structural considerations that I wanted to spend a few minutes thinking about. I want to focus on the questions of human rights in this regard. And the general thesis that I'm putting before you is that, at least under modern conditions, the way in which religion is getting dealt with in the peacemaking process is again and again, and I'll demonstrate this in a few minutes, is again and again with reference to human rights arrangements, which, by which I mean the guarantees of religious freedom, religious expression to the various religious parties who are involved in a given conflict. That's the first one, freedom of religious expression. The second one is guarantees of non-discrimination based on religion or belief. That is to say, in the public realm, it is understood that you will not be discriminated against, ill-treated, because of the religious identity or affiliation that you may have. And the third feature of this general approach of human rights arrangements in peacemaking has to do with guarantees of a particular sort for minorities within a given situation. My own work at the U.S. Institute of Peace very much focused in this set of questions. I looked at Bosnia, as Mr. Cohen pointed out. I've studied Sudan at some length. I've worked a bit on Israel-Palestine, though Mark knows that case much better than I do. I've worked extensively on Sri Lanka. And the three questions that I have always asked in regard to considering those particular cases is, first, to what degree is the conflict over the denial or violation of these three sets of rights that I've just given, freedom of religious expression, non-discrimination, and protection of minorities? To what degree is the violation of the violence that's characteristic of these conflicts a denial of those rights? The second question is the obverse of that. To what degree would the promotion of the rights that I've identified help to diminish the conflict and build a structure of peace in the conflict area, Bosnia, Sri Lanka, Sudan, Israel, Palestine, etc.? The third question, if the answer to the first two is yes, and in the studies that we did, the answer was yes in both cases. Yes, a denial of these rights is central to the conflict, to an arrangement whereby these rights would be guaranteed and institutionalized would diminish and would be key to the diminution of the violence in that particular case. The third question then is what groups in the particular case are, as a matter of fact, engaged in the promotion of these rights? The kinds of things that Mark alluded to in passing, that is to say, the construction of tolerance, of inclusion of others and their rites of ritual, their expressions of religion, etc. To what degree are people reaching out and attempting to create either formal or informal arrangements whereby those things take place? Until 1995, roughly from the post-World War II period up to 1995, there had been a marked increase in ethnic religious violence. But 95, you begin to see a sharp drop-off. Let me quote briefly from Ted Gurr's conclusions. By mid-decade, worldwide shift in strategies of ethno-political action was taking place. Examination of 59 armed ethnic conflicts underway in 1998 shows that de-escalating conflicts outnumbered escalating ones by 23-7. Few new ethno-political conflicts began after 1994. There was a sharp decline, according to Gurr, in addition, in secessionist wars, wars in which groups are fighting over territorial separation. And he enunciates three principles according to which he thinks an explanation for this sharp marked decline can be provided. The first and most basic, he says, is the recognition and active protection of the rights of minority peoples, freedom from discrimination based on race, national origin, language, or religion, complemented by institutional means to protect and promote collective interests. The second basic principle, according to which this incidence or sharp decline, I should say, can be explained, is the rise of political democracy and the protection that political democracy inclines to provide in regard to ethnic and religious minorities. And the third principle is that more and more governments, according to Gurr, are treating minorities by way of negotiation and accommodation rather than by repression and discrimination. So statistically, one finds some very interesting support, I should say, for the spread of the norms, rights that I was identifying and their importance in providing institutional conditions in which peace can be established and developed.
Harvard professor David Little. You've been listening tonight to a lecture by Tufts University professor Mark Gopin, followed by a response from Harvard professor David Little, part of Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion's lecture series on the paradox of religion as resource and threat.